It's Monday, July 21st, 2008, and it's 420 somewhere in the world. I'm your host, Radical Russ Belville. Produced and distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C., this is your normal daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Welcome to the most popular podcast regarding marijuana in all of America and all the world, featuring interviews with scientists, politicians, doctors, prohibition policy activists, regular cannabis consumers, musicians, and Normal's staff and Normal's board of directors, along with music and comedy no other podcast can offer. You can always find out more about our show at our website, stash.normal.org. and continue the education and conversation on our blog as well. We're ending marijuana prohibition with education, one listener at a time. The podcasting and blogging technology for the Normal Daily Audio Stash is provided by Red Aphid Interactive Media. For your professional web design needs, visit redaphid.com. Hey, welcome back to another week of the Daily Audio Stash. I had a lot of fun this weekend. I was involved down in Eugene, Oregon with the Emerald Empire Hemp Fest. And big thanks go out to Dan Kuser down there with Willamette Valley Normal and all the volunteers who helped to put on a successful hemp festival down there in the college town of Eugene. I was able to speak on Sunday afternoon, got to speak to all the people and tell them about our Oregon Cannabis Tax Act, where we're trying to get cannabis taxed and regulated through state-run liquor stores, trying to get that on the ballot for 2010, and check out cannabistaxact.org for more information on that. I also run the Oregon Normal Multimedia Information Booth, where we show videos of documentaries and presentations to help the cannabis community, including frequent showings of the Busted video from the Flex Your Rights organization. And if you haven't seen that video, you need to. Every cannabis consumer should. It's out at flexyourrights.org. Also showed a couple of great documentaries, a.k.a. Tommy Chong, the Josh Gilbert documentary on the story of Tommy Chong going to prison for 9 months for selling glass on the Internet, as well as the Kevin Booth movie American Drug War, kind of outlining how the American Drug War has continued and been funded by government agencies like the CIA. So lots of stuff for people to fill their head while they're there at the Emerald Empire Hemp Fest. And we'll also be there at Seattle Hemp Fest. So if you're there at Seattle, make sure to stop by the Oregon Normal booth and check that out. Now, coming up on today's show, we have an interview with Aaron Houston. He's the lobbyist from the Marijuana Policy Project working up on Capitol Hill. He's here to tell us about a new bill introduced by Senator Dianne Feinstein of California that would set severe criminal penalties for pot candy. That is, any sort of preparation of marijuana, even if it's medical marijuana, that would be enticing to children. And that would increase the penalties for that, which could even include medical pot brownies and other edibles that patients are using. Also, we'll be speaking with columnist Bill Steigerwald, who writes for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review, a conservative paper out of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And he had a rather scathing article about the DEA turning 35. So we'll discuss the drug war with Bill Steigerwald from Pittsburgh Tribune Review. All right, everyone, sit back and relax, grab yourself a hookah, and enjoy your normal daily audio stash. Now it's time to take a look at the latest stories about marijuana from news organizations across America and around the world in our normal daily audio stash, Hemp Headlines. Seattle police return medical marijuana files taken in raid, but not the pot. From the Seattle Times. Seattle police returned hundreds of patient files and a computer hard drive to Martin Martinez Thursday evening, 2 days after they raided his University District storefront where he runs a collective and outreach group for medical marijuana patients. Prosecutors have told Martinez he won't face any charges and the investigation is now closed. Douglas Hyatt, Martinez's lawyer, said, quote, "Nothing is going to happen. It's done," end quote. as he went to the Seattle Police Department Thursday to pick up the files and other belongings. But police have so far refused to return about 12 ounces of marijuana and two bongs seized during the Tuesday bust, Hyatt said. According to Hyatt, a police department attorney has promised that the drugs and water pipes won't be destroyed until Hyatt can raise the issue with King County prosecuting attorney Dan Satterberg or take the matter to court. Hyatt said, quote, "It's really the principle. If you have the legal right to have something, the police shouldn't be able to take it away from you and not give it back," end quote. And I'm still left wondering why the Seattle police are involved in this marijuana bust after the people passed I-75 directing them to treat marijuana law enforcement as their lowest priority. Washington State Supreme Court says pot smell isn't enough to arrest all the car's occupants. From the Seattle Times. Law enforcement officers who detect the odor of marijuana from a vehicle can't arrest all the occupants, the state Supreme Court ruled Thursday. In a unanimous ruling, the court determined the smell of pot isn't enough probable cause to warrant the arrest and search of everyone inside a car. While smell alone may be reason for a vehicle search, the court determined, it doesn't warrant handcuffing passengers without other supporting evidence. Defense attorneys on Thursday called it a right to privacy victory. Law enforcement officers say it won't greatly affect the way they make arrests. Summing up the state Supreme Court's decision, Justice Charles W. Johnson wrote, quote, "Our state constitution protects our individual privacy, meaning that we are free from unnecessary police intrusion into our private affairs unless a police officer can clearly associate the crime with the individual," end quote. Attorney David Zuckerman, who brought the case before the state Supreme Court, said the problem is that arresting someone based solely on the odor of marijuana can affect innocence. Zuckerman said, quote, "The smell of marijuana smoke can linger for weeks. You could have a perfectly innocent citizen get into a car where somebody smoked marijuana at some point, and an officer can just pull you out of a car and book you based on that," end quote. This may be a good thing to know as you're all road tripping up to Hempfest in Seattle. Not that any responsible adults would be smoking marijuana in their cars while driving, of course. And it wouldn't affect you anyway, because if you were to break a law and transport marijuana, you'd at least have the sense enough to place it in a smell-proof container and store it in the trunk so the state trooper would have nothing to smell. Still, it's nice to see a privacy-affirming ruling from a Supreme Court from time to time. Can cannabis compounds slow the progression of multiple sclerosis? The Cannabinoid Use in Progressive Inflammatory Brain Disease Study, or CUPID, at the Peninsula Medical School in Plymouth has reached an important milestone with the news that the full cohort of 493 people with multiple sclerosis, or MS, has been recruited to the study. CUPID is a clinical trial which will evaluate whether tetrahydrocannabinol, THC, one of the many compounds found in the cannabis plant and the main active ingredient, is able to slow the progression of MS. This is an important study for people with MS because current treatments either target the immune system in the early stages of MS or are aimed at easing specific symptoms such as muscle spasms or bladder problems. At present, there is no treatment which slows the progression of the disease. The CUPID trial follows an earlier study, Cannabinoids and Multiple Sclerosis, or CAMS, which suggested a link between THC and the slowing of MS. The CAMS trial saw participants take THC for a year. The CUPID trial will last longer and aims to assess the effect of THC on progressive MS. It has taken 2 years to recruit the 493 participants who will each take part in the trial for 3 years, and in some cases, 3.5 years. After data cleaning and analysis, the results should be available by spring or early summer of 2012. The anecdotal data are out there. I have personal experience with one MS patient who claims her cannabis regimen has halted the progression of her disease and allowed her to continue with her career as a graphic designer. This is the kind of study our government needs to be funding, instead of the constant attention to pseudoscience designed to show marijuana's alleged harms.
Stupid Stoner Stories. As a public service, Normal reminds you that smoking marijuana will not make one stupid. However, some stupid people do smoke marijuana. Don't be one of those stoners that make the rest of us look bad. Learn your lesson from today's
Stupid Stoner Story.
Custody for smoking pot inside an ice cream truck, police said. Gregory Westbury of Spring was arrested Thursday with marijuana possession and possession of drug paraphernalia. The 34-year-old's arrest report said his speech was slurred and his pupils were dilated when deputies found him. Westbury later admitted to smoking pot and drinking several beers inside the truck. Inside, deputies found less than a gram of marijuana in a clear plastic bag and a smoking pipe in his pockets.
If you're trying to smoke marijuana in secret, it helps if you don't follow the basic plot points of Cheech and Chong's Nice Dreams. On the other hand, when the guy had less than a gram of weed, but displays slurred speech and admits to drinking several beers, how come the headline isn't "Drunk Man Found Smoking Pot in an Ice Cream Truck"?
Now it's time to play Pass the Stash, where you can win cool prizes from Normal.
Hey Stashers, time for a brand new Pass the Stash contest. This one's going to run all the way through the end of July, so you've got till July 31st to get your entries in to stash@normal.org. Here's the contest, and it's inspired by conversation with a friend of mine, Scott, from Herb Age Designs. Check them out at herbagedesigns.com. And we were talking about what's the smallest amount you've ever heard of anyone being busted for marijuana, the smallest amount in possession. And Scott had quite a surprising answer. I'm not going to give it away yet because I want you guys to enter. So the person who can prove to me that they were busted with the smallest amount of marijuana in grams or less than a gram, just send me an email at stash@normal.org and you could win a copy of the DVD, a.k.a. Tommy Chong, the Josh Gilbert documentary that chronicles Tommy Chong's 9 months in prison that he served for selling bongs on the internet. If yours is the entry with the smallest amount and you can prove it by July 31st, you'll win the DVD. We'll just mail it right out to you. You can remain anonymous and you must be 18 or over to play. And thanks for playing Pass the Stash.
Hello, I'm Paul Stanford from the Hemp and Cannabis Foundation, or THCF. Medical marijuana is legal in 12 states today, and THCF has medical clinics in 6 of those states. Our physicians help qualified patients obtain an authorization for medical marijuana in their state. Patients are eligible for medical marijuana with a history of either severe chronic pain and or nausea, cancer, AIDS or HIV, hepatitis, glaucoma, seizure disorders like epilepsy, chronic muscle spasms, and multiple sclerosis or asthma, neurodegenerative diseases such as Alzheimer's, and gastrointestinal disorders like IBS or Crohn's disease. If you or someone you know has one of these conditions, our doctors will help them obtain a permit for medical marijuana. THCF Medical Clinics has offices in Washington State, Oregon, Colorado, Nevada, Hawaii, and California. Call 1-800-723-0188 or go to the web at www.hemp.org or 1-800-723-0188.
Here at the Normal Daily Audio Stash, we like to keep track of all the federal legislation that's happening that regards to adult marijuana prohibition. And a man who can help us with that is from the Marijuana Policy Project, the Director of Government Relations, Aaron Houston, who's joining us by telephone from Washington, D.C. Aaron, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. It's always an honor to be on.
Oh, thank you so much. First of all, let's remind everyone, I know we've said it before, and you've probably been going over this a lot, but let's remind everyone of the two bills that have been introduced by Ron Paul and Barney Frank before we get to this latest bill from Dianne Feinstein.
Certainly. Well, as you noted, the Medical Marijuana Patient Protection Act of 2008 was recently introduced by Barney Frank and co-sponsored by Congressman Paul. And that bill now has somewhere in the vicinity of around 20 co-sponsors, I believe. And additionally, the two of those members also introduced the decriminalization of marijuana bill in Congress, which would eliminate federal penalties for small amounts of marijuana, for possession of small amounts of marijuana, and for the not-for-profit transfer of an even smaller amount of marijuana.
Right, and these are H.R. 5842 and H.R. 5843, if I remember correctly.
That is correct. You got it.
All right. Now, the former bill, is this just basically a reinvention of the Hinchey-Rohrabacher Amendment?
Well, not quite.
Not quite.
The Hinchey-Rohrabacher Amendment is different in a number of ways. Number one, it would apply to only the year in which the appropriations bill is operating, to which it would be attached. So, in other words, if the Hinchey Amendment were to be adopted on the fiscal 2009 appropriations bill, then the Hinchey Amendment language would be law for only 1 year, whereas this legislation would have a binding effect in perpetuity. It would be a permanent change to federal law. Additionally, because the legislative vehicle and mechanism is somewhat different, the effect is somewhat different as well between the two measures. The Hinchey Amendment would merely bar the federal government from interfering in the state medical marijuana laws. The Barney Frank, Ron Paul Medical Marijuana Patient Protection Act would actually allow the states to pass their own policies on medical marijuana. And it would allow the states to either allow doctors to recommend or prescribe to patients marijuana for a certain number of medical conditions. It would allow the states that have already passed medical marijuana laws, the 12 states that have already passed medical marijuana laws, to have those laws in effect. So it is different in the sense that it is permanent and not temporary like the Hinchey Amendment is, and the policy reach is goes a little farther.
Yeah, permanent and more far-reaching. Okay. The latter bill, which Barney Frank had referred to on Bill Maher's show as the Make Room for Serious Criminals bill, that's the other bill that we're really excited about, the first federal decrim bill in years.
Yes, and it could be called, it's really the first major proposal to be advanced in Congress that would decriminalize marijuana since 1978. The last time this issue was seriously contemplated by Congress was, to my knowledge, in around January or February of 1978, when the Senate Judiciary Committee took up a measure similar to this. So this is a very exciting step forward for us. We are talking to a number of offices on both sides of the aisle. We've already had a number of co-sponsors sign on to the bill without us even asking them to. So it's very encouraging, and it is a major step forward, as you have indicated, in terms of the public debate, having a debate about whether or not we really want to focus on locking up or sentencing people for marijuana possession only. It just doesn't make sense, especially when you consider that we have a policy at our southwestern border, because the southwestern border is so overwhelmed right now. Our law enforcement agencies are so overwhelmed there that there is a policy among federal agencies patrolling the border down there that they have a catch-and-release system with non-nationals coming over the border with 500 pounds of marijuana or less. 500 pounds of marijuana compared to the 100 grams of marijuana that the Barney Frank and Ron Paul bill would make legal. So it is a major step forward, and it could rightly be called the Kingpin Act, or the Make Room for Kingpins Act of 2008.
Now, you've been lobbying for marijuana reform up on the Hill, and as far as I know, the only lobbyist on the Hill for marijuana reform for a while now. And Hinchey-Rohrabacher has been, you know, introduced for many years now, and it's gained more and more votes as it's gone along, but the progress has been slow. Do you feel like there's a sea change? Is there anything, a major change happening in the politics of Washington, D.C. that would give us a better outcome than we've had in the past?
Well, I believe Washington will always be a swamp that traded malaria for politics. but in that light, not much changes in Washington, whether Democrats or Republicans are in control. But that said, I think regarding this issue and regarding the way that drug policy reform has been approached and has been handled in the past by our policymakers. I think there's an increasing consensus that old way of doing things is simply not working. It has gotten us into a tremendous mess. We're spending huge amounts of money incarcerating people for drug possession only. And our system is frankly overwhelmed. And you've seen some courageous leaders in Congress like Senator Dodd and Senator Webb and others in the House like Chairman Frank talk about this issue in realistic terms and talk about it not only in terms of the moral issues and implications involved in locking up people for a drug, which is less harmful than the consequences of the drug use,
yeah.
In other words, getting locked up, but also from a resource standpoint. Senator Dodd on the campaign trail, for example, saying that it just doesn't make sense to lock up people for marijuana, that our prisons are overwhelmed, and that we need a new approach. So I do believe that we are seeing some positive movement there, despite the fact that we've seen marginal improvements on the Hinckley-Roebucker Amendment over the years. Frankly, I think a lot of members of Congress have seen the Hinckley-Roebucker Amendment as an endorsement of the activities that go on in the California medical marijuana system. And as we know, California's medical marijuana system is the oldest in the country. It was instituted with Proposition 215. And as time has gone on and more medical marijuana laws have been passed, those laws have been passed in a somewhat more restrictive way. That is a challenge for us in Washington, trying to explain the way the California system operates, because many members of Congress see the Hinckley Amendment as simply an endorsement of that system.
Yeah. Well, we'll keep our eyes on that. And then the other thing I definitely wanted to talk to you about here is this bill that Dianne Feinstein, the senator of California, has introduced about pot candy. Tell our listeners a bit about that.
Well, this is a very unfortunate piece of legislation, Senate Bill 1211, which was passed by the Senate Judiciary Committee at the end of June. And it's particularly unfortunate for a number of reasons, but in particular because this bill was really was advertised prior to its passage as a bill that was focused on methamphetamine.
Oh.
And the sponsors of the bill were being fairly quiet about the implications of the bill related to medical marijuana, and as we saw, and I and others and other groups associated with this fight at different points were sounding the alarm and educating members of the committee about the fact that this legislation would in fact cover not just methamphetamine, but also cover certain formulations of medical marijuana. Obviously, many patients in California prefer using an edible administration route, an oral administration route, rather than smoking the drug, and therefore those people have been put at risk. We were successful in securing some minor amendments to the bill, which included some language about intent, whether basically in order for the new enhancement, the penalty enhancement to trigger, and that's what this bill does. It creates a penalty enhancement for anyone who has created these marijuana candy or marijuana brownies or cookies even products that kicks in after the guilt phase of the trial and it comes in during sentencing. Well, the Marijuana Policy Project is obviously very opposed to children using marijuana. We are totally against that. We want to come up with effective drug policies that keep drugs out of the hands of our kids. And I'm a father of three, and I can say that I don't want my kids using marijuana. But we have to have a system that makes some sense. And we already have criminal penalties on the books that deal with people who give marijuana to children, rightly so. However, this penalty enhancement doesn't do anything to solve that or bolster that. It simply is a new penalty on top of whatever other penalty might be out there, for example, giving marijuana to children. So this is an extraneous, really a superfluous piece of legislation. It is unnecessary. We wish that Senator Feinstein would focus her efforts rather than grandstanding with this bill, focus her efforts on really investigating the DOJ's, the Department of Justice's involvement and the DEA's involvement in her own state's medical marijuana system, which was duly adopted by voters in 1996.
Absolutely.
We believe that she should be focusing on figuring out how to protect her state's residents from federal intrusion into their business on matters of criminal justice and on health policy, rather than coming up with new penalty enhancements that could ensnare people who happen to make pot brownies at home one night.
And just to get this straight, the bill as it reads right now is one that would increase the penalties if you were to package marijuana in such a way that it would be enticing to children. Is this referring just to marijuana, or are they also talking about, you know, like the lollipops that are hemp flavored but don't contain any drug THC?
Well, it applies to any controlled substance.
Okay.
So to the extent that any exceptions are written in for hemp or might be in the future, then, in other words, substances with very, very low THC, then it might not apply to that. But it applies to any controlled substance. Ostensibly, as I said before, the bill was aimed at methamphetamine after the bill passed. Unfortunately, Feinstein then noted to the press, actually, that this bill is also aimed at medical marijuana.
Yeah, and this I imagine was triggered in no small part by the chronic candies that get sold down in the California dispensaries in there, and they often make them look like, say, a Butterfinger bar, but they call it Budda-finger, right? That kind of situation. Is that what we're talking about here?
That is exactly what we're talking about. That is exactly the kind of activity that Senator Feinstein's bill targets. And again, we wish that instead of coming up with new penalty enhancements, that she would focus her attention on figuring out a way to come up with a comprehensive scheme of regulation in this country for medical marijuana that would help ameliorate some of the problems that we've seen in California with respect to the implementation of Proposition 215. Most of the problems that anyone could point to, the press or policymakers or anyone for that matter in California, really fundamentally relate to the fact that the federal government has no comprehensive scheme of regulation for medical marijuana, and that's what's lacking right now.
And in the California situation, even if they do have these candy bar looking edibles, medical edibles in these dispensaries, aren't they 21 and over? Can kids actually get into these dispensaries?
Well, I don't think that they legally can unless they have some kind of parental authorization, which I believe is what the law is in California anyway, that for a person under 18 it requires some sort of parental authorization, just as it would with any other medication. So, of course, no, I think to answer your question, indeed, people under 21 are not generally going to be going into dispensaries. I think the law in California is actually 18, so there is a gray area between 18 and 20, the ages of 18 and 21.
And also, in reference to this bill, and they're talking about enticing children, it wouldn't necessarily have to be the packaging looking like a candy bar or anything. I mean, you could interpret this as anything that makes marijuana taste good.
Well, I will say, as I said, I am the father of three kids, and like I said, I certainly don't want my kids using marijuana, but I can certainly say that Senator Feinstein's bill would probably ensnare people who perhaps not thinking about this new penalty enhancement happen to bake some marijuana brownies at some point, or let's say an HIV/AIDS patient who prefers an oral administration route, baking marijuana brownies in the wrong circumstances. I believe that even that private activity in that private individual's home could be subject to the penalty enhancement because, as I say, I'm a father of three kids. I can attest to the fact that kids love cookies and kids love brownies. And if there's marijuana in the cookies or brownies, you know, that it could probably be argued that it is somehow packaged to appeal to children.
Well, let's get all our listeners informed on who, what bill they exactly need to be fighting. This is Dianne Feinstein's bill. They can call their senator at, I believe, 202-224-3121. Is that the...
That's correct. That is the Capitol switchboard number. And the bill is Senate Bill 1211-1211 by Senator Dianne Feinstein of California.
All right. Everybody call your senators and tell them, no, we do not want that bill.
Yes,
Aaron Houston from Marijuana Policy Project, thanks for joining us here on the Daily Audio Stash.
Hey, thank you for having me. It's always an honor.
All right.
Just say no.
No matter what you call it, it's a huge part of popular culture.
Where'd you learn that, Cheech? Drug school.
You don't need weed school. You just need a copy of the new book, Pot Culture, the A to Z Guide to Stoner Language and Life.
Hey, this is great, man.
Even if you never smoked marijuana.
I never used marijuana. Sorry.
Don't think you smoked marijuana.
I experimented with marijuana a time or two and didn't inhale.
Or you used to smoke marijuana.
I inhaled frequently. That was the point.
Pot Culture by former High Times editor Steve Bloom and Shirley Halperin will answer every question you ever had about marijuana culture.
Has that marijuana made it back up here yet?
Check out Pot Culture, the A to Z Guide to Stoner Language and Life at Amazon.com or visit PotCultureBook.com today.
Too bad, man. I just stopped smoking yesterday.
Here at the Normal Daily Audio Stash, we work hard to change our nation's marijuana laws through education and discussion. But we also take time to relax and unwind with an eclectic mix of pod-safe music from many independent artists. We look for music that speaks to the growing truth about cannabis, or music that speaks to broader themes of freedom, liberty, social justice, equality, and protest. To find out more about the artists and download the music you hear on this podcast, just log on to stash.normal.org. And if you'd like to get your music heard by the online cannabis community, just send us an email at stash@normal.org. Welcome to Blue Monday, Stashers. You know, the kind of blues we're talking about when we say we have the searching blues. The Manish Boys bring us some amazing blues today with their musical take on the searching blues. The Manish Boys started out as an all-star West Coast blues review that were together for one studio project. Now, four CDs later, they're still belting out the blues with incredible skills, bending guitar strings and classic blues vocals. This album may be the best blues album out this year. If you're searching for great music, you found it here. For more information on the Manish Boys and their album Lowdown Feelin', check out our website at stash.normal.org, where you can also get a download of the MP3 for this song. It's the Manish Boys with Searchin' Blues.
Satisfaction, hear no more to that freight train. Hold on to If I were to tell you that in America, right now, over 1 million children sell marijuana, what would you think? Would you think that any public policy that creates over 1 million teenage marijuana dealers needs to be re-examined and possibly amended? You would not be alone. The members of the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, aka NORML, have been working since 1970 to reform marijuana laws such that responsible adults, not children, sell and use marijuana. Isn't it high time to reform America's misguided marijuana laws? This is Alan St. Pierre, Executive Director of NORML in Washington, D.C. Only concerned citizens can effectively end the federal government's nearly 70-year-old prohibition on responsible adult marijuana sales and use. Want to know more about how you can help? Contact us at NORML, toll-free, 888-67-NORML, or by visiting the organization's popular and informative webpage at NORML, NORML.org.
Well, we remarked just a couple of weeks ago about the 35th birthday of the Drug Enforcement Administration, and this got picked up in the Pittsburgh Tribune Review, and joining us by telephone is Bill Steigerwald, who's an associate editor out there at the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. Thanks for joining us here on the Daily Audio Stash.
Happy to be here.
Well, I saw your column, and it was called On the DEA's 35th Birthday, Not Much to Celebrate. What did you find in your reporting that you had to just share with all the readers there in Pittsburgh?
Well, I'm a real big fan of the drug war, the DEA, you know, all of this, you know, so I'm always looking for, that's sarcastic, by the way.
Yeah.
I'm always looking for, things, you know, that I can hang a column around. I do a column every week. And so, you know, and the DEA or the drug war always provides, I think, you know, eventually something comes along. And I just happened to notice this. I don't even know where. I just saw some of the numbers about the DEA and how it had grown like most bureaucracies do. They start small and with not a whole lot of money, but you know, you turn around and 10, 20, 30 years later, they're tripled or quadrupled in size and budget, and it has no, there's no connection between whether it's doing its job or well or not. In the case of DEA, of course, we would prefer that they disappear from the face of the earth, but, you know, they're given a job to do, and of course, like any government bureaucracy, they specialize in feathering their own nests, preserving their own jobs and budgets and things like that. So, and God knows whether, you know, I mean, how do you measure success with the DEA? Do you count people arrested? Do you count people tons of marijuana or, you know, heroin or whatever they find? It's all kind of silly.
Yeah. So in your opinion, this is more endemic of just the nature of bureaucracies and not necessarily just the fact that the drug war is an unwinnable type of a war.
No, I think, I mean, you know, that's what kind of struck me is when I saw it, I thought, you know, this is, the DEA is behaving like a typical bureaucracy. It's bloated. It's preserving its own power and budget. And in the case of the DEA, there are other government agencies. Let me think of one, the Agriculture Department, for instance. I think there are now more Agriculture Department employees than there are farms in America, things like that.
You know?
I mean, we can all rail about that. And as a libertarian, I've got plenty to rail about, obviously, with the $3 trillion federal government and big, fat, stupid state and even local governments now. But the DEA gets sort of special protection because it sort of wraps itself in this, we're fighting against drugs and we're protecting the children and all that moralistic, moralistic arguments that it and its supporters and all the politicians, of course, you know.
Yeah. It just seems like over the history of the United States, every time we declare war on something, we seem to get more of it.
Exactly. And I think the last time I mentioned the DEA or the drug war was just that here we, the federal government declares a lot of wars, a war on drugs, a war on poverty, the war on literacy, the war, plus wars in Iraq and they don't seem to win very many of them these days, you know. And it's just sort of the nature of the beast.
Now, do you think this is a particularly American phenomenon? You made a note in your column here about the World Health Organization study showing that, you know, places like China and Japan have lowest rates of drug use, and, well, they have bureaucracies too, and so what's the difference?
Yeah, obviously, well, I mean, you know, on one hand, it's a kind of a great racket that the DEA has. They're set up to police an activity, the peaceful taking of various drugs that is very popular. And so they're never going to run out of people to bust or bad guys to, you know, capture their boats or trucks loaded with dope, whatever. And because there's a, you know, because here in America, where we are much more free in a relative sense and in a real sense than most other countries, you know, people want drugs, and we still live in a country that has enough room and enough freedom where we can still pretty much get them if we really want them. And in fact, it's so easy to get that any sophomore in high school can get it.
Yeah, unfortunately. Now, as we look at this drug war, you know, a lot of this, like you say, I would say, is part of a self-serving bureaucracy, you know, trying to maintain their own power and their own budgets and such. A lot of what they are able to accomplish, to me, seems to be a function of the demonization of a certain class of people. You know, I always laugh when I hear the term drug-free America, and then that's followed by a Budweiser commercial, for example.
Yeah, right. Well, try to find a politician who, after 35 years or so of absolute absurd, by every kind of measurement, failure of this war on drugs, which is really a war on Americans and human beings and what they want to do, and I've always wanted to do, I guess, since they got out of caves. No politician seems to have the guts, no big time to really blast the war, to point to the emperor and say, hey, you know, for 35 years you've been naked.
Yeah, really.
You're wasting a lot of money and you're hurting a lot of people and I don't know how many people end up in jail, and there's all these arguments about how many people are really in jail for just plain old marijuana offenses, but let's put it this way, there's far, far too many.
Yeah, well, we're looking at coming up this October, we're estimating the 20 millionth arrest for marijuana since it was made illegal in 1937.
Really?
Yeah, and those arrests, you know, it doesn't matter whether you're going to jail or not. The arrest itself can have some devastating consequences for your career, your licenses, your reputation, and so on. And so since this is such a controversial sort of topic, when you published this in the Pittsburgh Tribune Review, what were some of the responses? Is the public generally on your side as far as this opinion?
I thought it was interesting. You know, I've written things like this before where I've just blasted the drug war and said things like, I believe that, you know, the Taliban would be proud of our drug policy. You know, I mean, they would support it probably 100%. There's hardly any difference. And with past columns, I would always get, I sort of get the automatic responses from the anti-drug war warriors, you know, various drug policy places and things. And, you know, they send emails or they send a letter to the editor, which is good. And, but I used to always get some sort of, you know, conservative Republican people who would say I was crazy and, you know, and how can you stick up for drug use and all that stuff. This time I got nothing. I only got support. And it's not like I get this avalanche of support, but, you know, maybe 10, 15 emails from our readers and letters. And also, I think this column is now appearing on townhall.com, which is a conservative and very Republican-oriented website, but they carry my columns, mainly because they get them for free. And I was curious to see whether they would even put this up, because this is a very, you know, this doesn't exactly fit their point of view. Though people like Weymouth Buckley and others were against the war on drugs, and Friedman and others. But, you know, the town hall, and sometimes they get a little squeamish about these kinds of things. But they did put it up, and I have gotten you know, about every hour or two, a little email will pop in, and they'll just say something quick and, you know, like, way to go, or, yeah, or, you know, I'm trying, you know, here's one, you know, here's one that came in, and it just says, wave the white flag. We've lost this war. Let's treat drug abuse the way that we treat alcohol abuse.
Yeah.
You know, so obviously they're, you know, and this came from God knows where, but it came because of the town hall and other places that are now posting this column.
Well, I think it's becoming more in the American consciousness, and despite, you know, whether you'd consider yourself on the left or the right, you know, on the left, you can look at it as, you know, a liberal, I have the right to do with my mind what I wish. On the libertarian side, you can say government shouldn't interfere. On the conservative side, you can say it's a bureaucratic waste of money. There's a reason for everyone to be against this, the war on drugs, the way it's being waged these days.
I dare say the smarter you are, the more you see the absurdity of this, of the drug war, even if you don't think, you know, I mean, obviously I'm 60 years old. I'm not running around smoking dope or doing anything like that. But, and I suspect that my 22-year-old son may be, but I'd hate to see him get arrested for it. But I think that people who, you know, younger, smarter people tend to see what's going on and understand that this is a horrible mess. And yet the older people who should know about what happened when we tried alcohol prohibition and all the horrible things that it did to society and to people and to, you know, cops and to judges and to the fabric of society and the rule of law and everything else, you'd think that they would get the parallel between drug prohibition and alcohol prohibition. But you know what? They don't. I kept hoping that as people my age and who are following me, you know, the aging baby boomers, that things would change, that there would be pressure on politicians, because that's where it has to come from, to end the drug war, to at least ratchet it down to where, you know, it turns, you know, from criminalizing drug use to trying to treat it, you know, if they want to try, you know, if that makes them feel better, that would be an improvement over what they're doing now.
I've been speaking with Bill Steigerwald, who's an associate editor at the Pittsburgh Tribune Review, and his column is available up on the Trib Review website. We'll have a link to that at stash.normal.org, and thanks for joining us.
Sure, thank you.
Thank you for downloading the Normal Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. We are produced by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. Our executive producer is Alan St. Pierre. Our deputy director is Paul Armentano. Our webmaster is Brian Judy. And web production is provided by Red Aphid Interactive Media. As always, you can catch up on the latest information about marijuana at www.norml.org. And you can interact and download from our Audio Stash blog at stash.normal.org. For everyone here at Normal, I'm your host, Radical Russ Belville, hoping all your harvests are bountiful and your encounters with law enforcement are non-existent. We leave you today with another one of our cannabis quotes, this one from the U.S.-Jamaican study of 1974, which concluded, quote, "No impairment of physiological, sensory, and perceptual performance, tests of concept formation, abstracting ability, and cognitive style, and tests of memory. Cannabis smoking does not lead directly to mental or physical deterioration. Those who have consumed marijuana for a period of years showed no mental or physical deterioration which may be attributed to the drug." End quote. Well, the evidence is out there. It's been out there for thousands of years. Humanity has been using cannabis, hemp, marijuana, ganja, whatever you want to call it, for thousands of years, and will continue using it for thousands more. I'm Radical Russ. Thanks for joining us here on the podcast, and hope we see you out there in the streets one of these days at one of our rallies or festivals. Remember, you got to get involved if you want to have a serious shot at changing the laws to end adult marijuana prohibition. Thanks for joining us, and until next time, Take care of each other, Tokers.